Today I told you about all the stages of meditation and how easy it is. So everyone has probably at least got into jhanas today. But in case you haven't, this is actually the problems of meditation and how to deal with them. In particular, I'd like to bring to mind that metaphor which I gave yesterday of going in, to find out the heart of meditation. And that's a very beautiful metaphor, to go to the centre of things. It is not just the way to calm the mind, but it's also the way of wisdom. There's even like a word for that in Pali called Yoniso Manasikara. And that word literally means that work of the mind, that's Manasikara, which goes to the source, which goes to the womb, which goes to the origin of things. Because the word yoni is the same word as the word of a womb, an origin, a source. So it's going to the centre of things, the origin. And that is always the way to find wisdom in Buddhism, by going to the source of things. And it's also the way to get depth in meditation, to get peace and stillness. As I mention often in these talks, that wisdom and peace lie in the same place. And because they lie in the same place, that there's no such difference between calm and insight meditation. Insight lies in calm, calm lies in insight. And because of that, they lie in the same place. Therefore the path is the same. And going inwards to the source of things, I think you can get the metaphor, the understanding. It's going in to where you are, not going out onto something else. And when you understand that's the basic movement of meditation, going in rather than going out, going onwards, and you can understand why the hindrances to meditation begin with those major forces which stop you going inwards, which push you out. I think many of you will remember the story of the Buddha before he was enlightened. And part of the enlightenment story was where the Buddha took his bowl and put it in the river Nirandjara and made a determination, if this bowl goes against the current, goes upstream, then maybe that I'll have the supporting conditions for full enlightenment. And the story went that he put his bowl in the river and it did flow against the current, it went upstream. And he took that as an omen that enlightenment was ready to happen. However, it's more than just an omen, because for the rest of his teaching career, he always mentioned that as a meditator, you have to go against the stream. You go against the stream of the world. And what actually does that mean, against the stream of that world? You can actually see that in one's meditation, because the stream of the world, the stream of our conditioning, is always to go out onto something else. To get the next thing, to reach for the next experience. Not being satisfied with this, but thinking that happiness, fulfillment, enlightenment lies somewhere out there, somewhere over there, in the next moment, in the next meditation, in the next place, in the next time. And that is like the stream of the world, always going outwards. As I mentioned, the stream of meditation is learning how to go inwards, to go against that stream. There's even a word for that in Pali, which is the asavas, the outflowings of the mind, which if you read in any Buddhist text, they're still usually translated as the taints. And sometimes that when you read those teachings in the translations, in the English translations, it doesn't really have much of a meaning of a taint. What is a taint? Is it like some sort of stain or dirty thing you've got to wash out? But when you actually translate it more in its literal meaning, and it's actually true meaning, it's the flowing out of the mind. And you can understand that in meditation experience, how you're sitting in here and the mind wants to flow out into fantasy, flow out into expectations and dreams and plans, or flow out into the past, or flow out into the next moment. Now I'm going to meditate, now I'm going to watch the breath, now I'm going to do something. But what you mean is in the next moment. And that's always the mind flowing out, going away from the source, but going in the opposite direction. And that basically is the main hindrance in meditation. Literally going in the wrong direction. Being pushed away from the source into other things. But the Buddha in his wisdom described that flowing out in five particular ways. You know, the five hindrances. And it's good to use those that paradigm, that map called the five hindrances, because like all these skillful means, just allow you to find out exactly where you are and what the problem is and be able to diagnose it. And those five hindrances, when they're really understood and when they're recognized and they're overcome, show you the way to deep meditation. Many of you have heard those five hindrances before. They are sensory desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry and doubt. It's a fifth hindrance. But especially the first two are always called the major hindrances, because those are the things which you can see very clearly, push you away from the present moment, from silence, from the breath, from nimittas, from anything. They stop you being still. And look at sort of our desire, I want. What do you want? What is always about the future? What's coming next? It's desiring something else. And you find that nearly all of your life you are following that force, thinking that happiness lies in the lunch, which is, this morning maybe you thought that happiness lies in breakfast. Having finished with breakfast, now happiness lies in lunch. Now happiness lies in the next meditation. And after a while, happiness lies in Saturday afternoon next week when you finish with this place. Because a lot of time we always think that happiness lies somewhere in the future. And see that most people live their life like that. Always what we call chasing rainbows. We call it chasing rainbows because when you follow a rainbow, it always recedes away from you. You can never reach it. It promises that it can be reached. That's the illusion of it. It seems that it's just over there. And they have this symbol in the West of, like, at the end of the rainbow is that pot of gold. Like the end of the rainbow of craving, there is the pot of gold of fulfillment, satisfaction, ultimate contentment. But because whenever you go towards that rainbow, it recedes further away from you. You can never reach that fulfillment, that contentment, that happiness. And that's what happens with this desire. And whenever you follow that desire, you can't really reach it. Whenever you sort of seem to grab it, there's always another rainbow moves in front of you, so there's another desire waiting for you next. The way of desire is always pushing you away from where you are now, with promises, with laws of something more, something better. And so that this is where we have to recognize this is a hindrance. This is something which is pushing us away from this moment now, with some expectation that the next moment will be better, that the next meditation will be the one, the next experience, the next retreat, the next relationship, the next job, whatever it is, the next life will be the good one. And you find that that sort of desire will never allow you to go into the centre of things. It is, as it were, being at the centre, pushing you out from your real home of contentment, no desire, stillness. For a couple of years in my meditation life, I used a mantra to overcome that hindrance. I kept on saying to myself, no desire, no desire, no desire, no desire. So whatever was happening in my meditation, just no desire. I made the absence of desire the main thing in the meditation. Even though sometimes it was sleepy. I said, it doesn't matter. No desire, be sleepy. If it's restless, no desire, be restless. No desire, whatever was happening, I said, no desire, no desire, no desire, no desire. To be able to weaken that force in the mind, which is always thinking the next thing will be the enlightenment experience. The next thing is wisdom. That peace, truth, wisdom lies somewhere out there, out from where you are. That somehow you're separated and you have to move from where you are to where truth lies. And after a while that you discover that it's only through overcoming desire, through letting go, through suspending it, that you can gain the peace, the overcoming of that hindrance. Usually I say the opposite of that hindrance, the antidote, is happiness. And because this is the first hindrance, and perhaps the biggest of the hindrances, that I make a lot of developing happiness in the meditation, happiness being here. Now try to make it a good fun retreat. Because if you're not enjoying the retreat, if you're not having fun, then desires will come up of themselves. You want something else. Having watched my mind very closely for so many years, you realize its nature, its very nature, is to incline towards happiness. It wants happiness, just like your body wants food. And just like the trees bend towards the sun, so too does the mind incline towards happiness. And if it doesn't get fed happiness, if it doesn't get fed joy, then it will get very weak. It will get even psychotic. Psychosis usually comes when a person hasn't got enough happiness and joy in their life. And it's like a starving of the mind. The mind gets very weak. And usually the reaction to that is like desiring, wanting. If you are very happy, if you have got lots of joy, you find you don't desire anything more. The times when you have been the most still in your life, the times when you have been calm, they're always the happy times. Times when there's lots of joy, even bliss in the mind. And that should give you the clue, the idea of like how that desire is overcome. It's by putting joy into the mind, into the moment, into this, right now. Realizing that what you're experiencing now is actually very, very beautiful and very, very joyful. And if you put that energy into the mindfulness, energy into the moment, energy into the silence, you find that instead of seeking something else and wasting your energy out there, you're conserving the energy and putting it in here with what's going on, where you are. It's what I call in meditation putting energy into the knowing, into mindfulness, and taking away from doing, from controlling. Doing and controlling is always desire. It's somewhere in the future. It's never where you are right now. As soon as you desire something, the focus is outside of the present moment. It creates the breaking up of silence. When there's desire, you can never be watching the breath which is happening now. If you have desire, when a nimitta comes up, it disappears straight away. The causes and conditions for that nimitta to arise are completely gone. And within the stable states of jhana, there's no desire whatsoever. That hindrance is completely disappeared. Because you're still in the moment, right here, with what's happening. And you see that it's the happiness which quells that desire. If you're happy where you are, then why would you want something else? Why would you need something else when you're happy with where you are? And it's this putting happiness into the moment, putting happiness into the meditation, putting happiness into silence, into the breath, whatever you're doing, is such an important way of overcoming this first hindrance. There's many ways of putting happiness into one's meditation. After a while it comes naturally, because the main key of happiness is mental energy. And sometimes it's difficult to overcome that hindrance in the first couple of days of the meditation retreat, simply because one is coming from a place of tiredness out there in the world. Sometimes you don't realize just how tired your mind is. I do recall when I was doing my about final examinations at Cambridge, just how mentally tired I was. But I only realized that when I started meditating during the lunch breaks and be able to let go of all of the worry about the past and the future and come to the present moment. And there, I was shocked to find out how just mentally exhausted I was. And that was actually just quite a moving experience for me, because it showed me that how you can be tired, mentally worn out for days and days on end and not realize it, not know it, simply because you're not paying attention to where that tiredness is, which is in the moment inside of you. And I think that many of you will be tired, and it'll be hard actually to encourage that happiness straight away. You'll take time to build up that energy of the mind. When you build up that energy of the mind, just all of the energy goes into mindfulness rather than into doing. And so you can imagine just energy building up, not being wasted, all being conserved and put into one spot. And that's where you build up the real happiness which overcomes that first hindrance. When the mindfulness gets very strong, very bright, very brilliant, very happy, because of all the energy is going, not into doing, but into knowing, then that's a natural way of overcoming that first hindrance of desire. You're so content you don't want to do anything. There will come times in this meditation retreat, I hope, when the bell goes for breakfast or lunch, and you're sitting here and you decide, no, I don't want to go to lunch. I'm more happy in my meditation, even though I won't eat for another 20 hours or so. I'd rather stay in the meditation rather than eat. That's the sort of happiness which you get in meditation. You don't want any desire whatsoever because you're so happy where you are. It's much better if that happens at breakfast time, because then you don't have to wait so much longer to the next meal. But nevertheless, it's lovely when that happens, when you're just sitting there and you're so happy. You know, what's the big thing with eating? And that's that inner happiness which stops that desire. Okay, so if you haven't got to that stage of the meditation, how do you actually stop that hindrance of desire which, you know, makes you go off and want something else, go fantasizing, dreaming, planning, imagining what the next meal is going to be, whatever else it is. How do you actually stop that? By actually deliberately developing the perception of happiness in meditation. It's called like the subha sanya. Subha is like the beautiful, perception of the beautiful, perception of the happy. There is another type of meditation which is actually perception of the unhappy. The repulsive, which is great to do in the world outside. But the trouble with that repulsive meditation, this is when people meditate on corpses or death and stuff like that. Monks love getting into that sort of stuff, they're really weird. No, we're not weird. But the trouble is that when people do that, the super meditation, they take it not just to the world outside, to the unwholesome things in the world, but they also take it to the wholesome stuff as well. They also apply it to the world inside and the beautiful states of meditation, the happiness, the peace. And they neglect, or rather they reject that as well. So it's good to do asupa for the world outside. This is the perception of the repulsive in the world outside. But it's very useful at the same time to the perception of the beautiful inside. The perception of the beautiful inside means, isn't it wonderful that on this day here we have no work to do? We have no family to look after. We have no bills to pay. We have no driving to do. We have no letters to write, no phone calls to make. And we actually perceive the beauty of that, the freedom of it. Isn't it wonderful just where we are today? How free we are. It's not going to last very long. In 2 weeks' time, you'll be back working. Working in your monastery, or working in your office, or working in your home. So easy to forget just how fortunate is this moment. This is called the perception of the beautiful. We perceive the beautiful. Isn't it wonderful that we are healthy and fit enough to be able to sit down in this meditation retreat which we've come to? And to practice the way of the Buddha. It's so rare to have a human birth. And for those who have a human birth, it's so rare to meet the teachings of the Buddha. And it's even rarer to be able to practice according to those teachings. Isn't this wonderful? It's a wonderful moment here. Isn't it wonderful to be able just to sit down here and have the freedom? There's no wars going on. We're well fed. We're protected. The weather is not too cold, not too hot. There's not much noise going on. We have the freedom to be able to sit meditation. With that perception of the beautiful in this moment, it gets very easy to overcome desire. Isn't it wonderful? We've just got a breath to watch. That's all. Nothing else needs to be done. This is the way we develop the perception of the beautiful. We can start to play with the breath, to start to make it interesting by reflecting that this breath can carry the oxygen which comes from the trees, the grasses and the flowers outside. It brings you life. And you take in that oxygen, and when you breathe it out again, you're breathing out carbon dioxide, which is what the grass and the trees and the flowers need to live. You're breathing in life from the nature, and you're breathing out life to nature. So you can develop the perception of the beauty. You're part of nature, you're giving and receiving with your breath, with every breath you're taking. That makes the breath very beautiful and very wonderful. When you're breathing in, you're breathing in peace. When you're breathing out, you're breathing out compassion for the world. Sometimes the people think that the Theravada and Mahayana, Theravada is selfish, Mahayana just into compassion and they don't do anything for themselves. When you're breathing in, you're both Theravada and Mahayana. You're breathing in for yourself and you're breathing out for others. Breathing in peace, breathing out compassion. What you're doing here is just making the breath very beautiful. With added perceptions, you're developing the perception of the beautiful. However you develop that, you can make the breath just such a wonderful, beautiful thing. When it's happy, when you add beauty to it, then where can the desire come in? However, if you're unskillful in your meditation, breathing in, breathing out, here we go again, another hour, how long to go to lunch? How long are we going to do this for? Maybe I should go and take a rest, as Ajahn Brahm says. I've been meditating 5 minutes already, that's enough, now go rest. Whatever it is, if you develop the opposite and don't develop the happiness in meditation, you're making the meditation not work. You're allowing the hindrances actually to swallow you. So develop the happiness in the meditation, whatever it is. Play with meditation, because you know what it's like in school. As a school teacher, I was always taught, this is when teaching school, teaching people how to be teachers, if you make the lesson fun, then the children, they pay attention, and number two, they learn. Basic child psychology. It's also basic meditation psychology. If you make the meditation fun, then you pay attention and you behave. And also you learn something. But if you make the meditation boring, dull, negative, then desire is going to come into your mind and you never get peace. So you make it fun. Which is why the other ways of dealing with that hindrance is actually breathe backwards. The breathing backwards method? It's a great method for playing around. So breathe out first and then breathe in. For those of you who think that's silly, you try that. You breathe out first and then breathe in, then breathe out and breathe in. It's a completely different ball game. So what actually you're doing, you're just playing around, just to make it fun, just like a kid does. And then when you make it fun, you find that the breath is very easy to watch. And it's very easy to watch because of happiness you're putting into it. The first hindrance just doesn't come up. And it gives you enough time by putting these crutches in to get enough energy into mindfulness, enough energy into stillness, to take it away from doing things, enough time to really build up the energy in the mind. And then happiness comes quite naturally. When it comes quite naturally, it just overcomes that hindrance. So first of all, you have to mess around to get happiness up. And then after a while, it comes up quite naturally. And then that first hindrance is completely gone. When you're happy to be inside, it goes inner and inner and inner. It keeps on going in that direction because of inner happiness. The second hindrance is called ill will. And that ill will, again, is the second of the great hindrances. Just as desire pulls you out from the present moment, or from the silence, or from the breath, from this, the ill will pushes you out. One is the outside pulling at you. Ill will is the inside pushing you away. And that is also a huge hindrance in our meditation. We're not talking here about ill will towards other people, because people in this retreat are such nice people. If you get angry at any of the people in here, my goodness, you've really got a problem. Because these are wonderful people in this retreat. So really, the hindrance of ill will is not going to come with people in this retreat. A lot of time it goes with yourself, or more likely just with this moment. This moment isn't good enough. You're looking with negativity at this present moment. You're looking with negativity at yourself, at your cushion, at the monks, at the cook, whatever. It's so easy to look at the faults. And this is actually what happens, where negativity comes from. It comes from this fault-finding mind of ours. Now you've all heard me say the simile of the two bad bricks in the wall. The reason why I keep on repeating that is because how powerful that is. Not only in identifying the problem, but also in showing the solution to fault-finding. So easy, actually, for some of you to come into like a room like this and see all the crucifixes on the wall, and especially if you've had a sort of bad experiences, maybe in a Catholic school or whatever. It's fault-finding. Look what's to the left and the right of that picture. So what? Big deal. There's nothing wrong with that. But isn't it amazing if that's... I know there was one lady who would come on these retreats. She's a very nice meditator, very good person, good Buddhist, but she had bad experiences in a Catholic school. So as soon as she came to this place, you know, she couldn't meditate. She had a terrible time here. And it was just because of the fault-finding mind. You couldn't sort of focus to the left and right of things. It's the same with this moment, whatever it is. You're sitting here, you're watching the present moment. Why is it that you can't stay in the present moment? Why can't you stay in silence? Why can't you stay with the breath? Fault-finding. It's not good enough. I want jhana. Now! My, I'm just hopeless. I am hopeless. It's fault-finding with yourself. This cushion, have you ever sat on a meditation cushion and you can't, you know, find a place which isn't lumpy? I must admit, I've done that with my cushion. There's a lumpy bit, so I turn it round. There's another lumpy bit there. I keep on turning it round and round and round. I bash it up to try and sort of make it soft, and it's still lumpy. And I realise it's not my cushion that's lumpy, I'm lumpy. The lumpy actually did here. Bit of like the fault finding. What I'm saying here, doesn't matter just how lovely your cushion is. Whether you're one cushion meditator, or two cushion meditator, or three cushion meditator, you should get much more as the retreat goes on. It doesn't matter, just it's never enough if you've got the fault finding mind. The food would never be good enough, no matter Trung puts so much care and attention and love into making cooking food. People give so much, and you give so much. So when you've got the fault-finding mind, we can never stay with anything. And that's the second of the big hindrances which stops you meditating. And what's the opposite of the fault-finding mind? It's called loving-kindness, metta. This is the solution to that. That's why, because fault-finding is such a strong hindrance in Western society, that's why we need to do a lot of loving-kindness. So we do loving kindness towards the present moment. This moment has come to you magically. It's a cosmic moment. Be kind to it. Whatever it is, sometimes you think it's painful, sometimes you think it's not enough, sometimes you think you've got a raw deal. When all the present moments were dealt out in this meditation room, you were the last in line and got the worst. Don't even think like that. Develop this sense of loving kindness. I'm so happy to have a present moment, you know, in this meditation retreat. Isn't it wonderful that I'm awake, I'm alert, I'm here? When you have loving kindness towards the present moment, you're embracing it. When you're embracing it, you're being with it, you're letting it be. And sometimes we need to do that loving kindness in the present moment, because sometimes it's hot, sometimes we're tired, sometimes we're not in jhana yet. And you look at your mind and you think, this is not good enough. It is good enough. There's a type of meditation which is done in Thailand, which is like pordi. You know pordi? Good enough. So you look at this mind, this is good enough. It's a very powerful meditation because it's very close to loving kindness. It's good enough. All you meditators, you're good enough. All you monks, you're good enough. This is it, it's good enough. What you're doing is you're taking away the negativity. You're having gratitude for this moment. Gratitude for your cushion. Gratitude for your mind. Gratitude for the present moment. Gratitude for silence. Rather for fault finding. And when we have gratitude, we embrace it. Present moment, silence, the breath, the door of my heart's open to you. It's called mindfulness. The door of the heart is open, you're allowing it to be, come in, you're mindful. If you say you're not good enough, get out of here, that's called ill will. No wonder you can't stay. So you're pushing things out of your mind, rather than allowing things to come in. Allowing things to be. So invite the present moment in every moment. Invite silence in. Be kind to silence. Be kind to your breath. This is overcoming that hindrance of ill will with kindness. So be careful. Whatever you experience in the meditation, it's very easy to see the two bad bricks or to see the crucifix which you don't like in your meditation mind. If you're not careful, that will create so much ill will and tension, you'll never get anywhere in your meditation. Whatever comes up, welcome. Allow it to be. Let go. And that way, you're overcoming the hindrance which pushes you away from this which you should be experiencing right now. You're allowing things to be. And that's the hindrance of ill will. So easy to have that ill will towards yourself as well. I'm hopeless, I can't do this, I've been coming here for so long, it just doesn't work, I can't do this. That's also ill will towards yourself as well. You know, according to Buddhism, according to the teachings, the only people who can't get into jhanas and who can't get enlightened in this lifetime, in this retreat, are people who've killed their mother, or murdered their father, or created a schism in the Sangha, or killed an arahat, or shed the blood of a Buddha. What's the other ones? I think that's enough. Have you done any of those yet? Please put your hands up if you've ever shed the blood of the Buddha. Put your hands up if you killed your mum or killed your dad. And if... Rape to none, yeah. You rape to none. That's a arahat nun, isn't it? Have you done that yet? If you haven't, then you can get into jhana in this retreat, and you can get enlightened as well. I say that because sometimes people think, oh, I can't do it, I'm hopeless. That's just ill will again. You say that to say, yeah, you can do it. According to the suttas of Buddha, you can. If you haven't, so that any of those rotten things, then the doors are open to you. So don't have ill will towards yourself, saying I'm hopeless. There's no such word as I can't. The only word is I haven't yet. Of course it might take quite a few more lifetimes, but it's I haven't yet. But I haven't yet, that's all. So don't have ill will. And the other hindrance is, those are the two main ones. That's why big world, don't go looking at the faults in the moment, in this meditation. Sometimes, just should mention, that sometimes that we think we've had a bad meditation. There is no such thing as a bad meditation. That's the other thing I remember from my first meditation teacher. He's a great teacher. He said, no such thing as a bad meditation. That took away a lot of the ill will, because sometimes I sat there and I thought I wasn't getting anywhere. You say you were getting somewhere. You're building up the karmic causes. You're doing the work. As I said in our book, The Basic Method, Monday, Tuesday, you go to work, get nothing. Wednesday, Thursday, you still get nothing. Friday, you go to work just as hard, you get a paycheck. And you think, why can't every day be Friday? Maybe you just go to work on Fridays, that's all. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you stay at home. And that's what we think in meditation, exactly the same. When you have a good meditation, ah, great, now I can do my meditation. Why can't all the meditations be like that? Why can't every day be Friday? Because those things you think as bad meditations, that's where you do the work. That's where you build up steam. And so, you know my old saying, that if it hasn't worked yet, if you haven't gone to jhana yet, you know, the paycheck is in the mail. It's coming. You're still building up steam, building up the requisites for deep meditation. And it must come, it will come. So don't have negativity, to think you can't do it. Don't have negativity, fault finding towards the meditation objects. I've done that before by practicing loving kindness together with the breath. Brilliant combination. It's this beautiful breath coming in. Sometimes I regard it like as a baby. You know, as you're holding a baby, you're rocking it backwards and forwards. Breathing in, you rock the baby to the left. Breathing out, you rock the baby to the right. Breathing in, rock the baby to the left. Breathing out. Because not even a man would drop a baby. Let alone a woman. But you drop the breath, don't you? So say, it's just like going to the shops with your baby, and then sort of, you know, so where's the baby gone? That's what happens with the breath, isn't it? You start washing the breath, breathing in, breathing out, and then you're thinking about lunch. Where's the breath gone? You've dropped it, you've left it somewhere. Why? Because you don't love it, you don't care for it. That's why the breath doesn't stay. So you put loving kindness on the breath, beautiful breath, like a little baby. Rocking it to the left, to the right, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. You're putting a bit of interest and love in the breath. And you find it becomes very beautiful and lovely. And you're taking away the ill will. Now sometimes in some meditation techniques they say you must watch the breath. Grit your teeth and just watch. Don't let go. And that creates such negativity towards the breath. And I mention this because there was one monk some years ago who was just forcing himself on that type of method for so long that it became traumatic for him to start meditating. Because he built up such ill will towards the breath, as soon as he had to watch the breath, so much negativity came up, as if he had to stay with an enemy, which he didn't like. Eventually, he disrobed, because he never actually got some good teachings about the breath, and just forced himself onto the breath for so long. He had so much negativity, it just made him, just meditation became torture. That's the wrong way to go, that's an extreme. But develop loving kindness on the breath, this beautiful breath like a baby. This breath has looked after you all these years, bringing you oxygen, taking away all the bad products, or the waste products. Be kind to it. With that loving kindness, you're taking away the fault finding. You become much more generous to your abilities. You're not so harsh and judgmental. Because fault finding is being judgmental. So, see if you develop that loving kindness, and that overcomes that second hindrance of ill will. Those are the main two hindrances which stop you meditating and having success. One is desire, which pulls you away from the present moment, from the centre. Ill will is what pushes you away from the centre. The other hindrances, which I'll go through, like sloth and torpor, is my favourite hindrance. The reason I say it's my favourite hindrance, because it's a hindrance which is the less troublesome. Because you're already calm and it's only a matter of time when you sort of wake up and get your energy going and do really well. Many monks, I used to be a great nodder in the early days of my meditation. And I know many other monks who used to have trouble with sloth and torpor, including the great Mahamoggallana, one of the Buddha's chief disciples. And they all ended up being great meditators. It's amazing. And I was very pleased when I came across a sutta in teaching of the Buddha where he was going on walking in this forest with Ananda, and he saw this one monk on the edge of the forest sitting absolutely straight. His back was straight, his mind was concentrated. So it looked from the outside, and the Buddha sort of turned around to Ananda and said, "I'm worried about that monk." And sure enough, a few weeks later, he disrobed. When he went further into the forest, he saw another monk meditating, nodding backwards and forwards, almost falling over, and the Buddha smiled. "I'm not worried about him." And a couple of weeks later, he became fully enlightened. It's a wonderful story. And the reason is because a lot of times those people you see absolutely straight are just doing it through willpower, through force, control freaks. I knew a monk like that. He was a French monk who on the outside looked like a perfect monk. Now he'd always sit straight, you know, all night and hardly ever look sleepy at all. But then he suddenly, just out of the blue, said he was disrobing. So we asked him why. And he said that all that time, 3 or 4 years, he was controlling himself so much he couldn't stand it any longer. And he said that sometimes on those all-night sits we used to do, he'd look around at the monks who were half asleep. He was jealous. He said at least they had to bear with this mind which wouldn't let go. And when I heard that, I felt so much sort of sadness and compassion for that monk. And I also realized something very important, that you can control the body and sit straight like a ramrod and impress other people. But it's not coming from the right place. It's coming from control. And that's why that first monk that the Buddha saw, just a control freak monk. And there's many of those in here, in you, as well as up here. If you're that control freak monk, then you can't stand it very long, much longer. So it's much better to go to that sleepiness. You're letting go. Why are you so proud? What's wrong with going to sleep in meditation? Thinking, now what's other people going to say about me? That's just pride, isn't it? So you're letting go. So that's not such a huge hindrance, sloth and torpor. Eventually, just let it deals with itself in due course. What's happening, as many of you have heard me say before, the two parts of the mind, the doer and the knower. When you're calming the mind, people, first of all, they calm both at the same time. They calm the doer and the knower at the same time. So you stop doing things, you stop thinking, you stop moving, but also you stop knowing as well. The knower gets very dull. And that's a mistake from sloth and torpor. But at least you're calming things. After a while, you recognize the difference between the doer and the knower, between mindfulness and controlling. And you keep the mindfulness very strong. You keep the knower. And you just calm down half of the mind, the doing. Then you're very still, but very alert. So the sloth and torpor, not a big deal. So anyone who feels that's a problem, you're doing well. Worse than that is the opposite of that, is restlessness. And that is a killer. Because when it's restlessness, you're never happy wherever you are. You sit on a chair and you're not happy. So you go sit on a cushion, you're not happy. You try one of these stools, you're not happy. You just go and lay down and you're not happy. You go and eat, you're not happy. Or maybe you're happy when you eat. But you're never happy wherever you are. It's that restlessness. And again, that's very close to ill will, because it's the same thing, the fault-finding mind. That's why the opposite of restlessness is this thing, wonderful thing we call contentment. Because when you're content, only then are you still. When you're happy to be here, you're content, then there's rest. Discontent will always be restless. So how can you find contentment in the world? Do you have to be a perfect meditator? Do you have to be in jhana? Do you have to have enlightenment? Do you have to have everything just so beautiful to be content? Of course the answer is no. You can be content anywhere, at any time, in any situation. No matter how uncomfortable, painful or unpleasant it is. Which is a great teaching of the Buddha. That contentment is in the mind, it's not out there. Contentment is allowing this to be. Being content. As I was saying the other day, yesterday, the simile of being in a prison or being in a monastery. If you're content to be there, then you're free. When you're free, there's no restlessness anymore. You're not trying to escape. You're not trying to do something else. You're not trying to move backwards and forwards. So it comes a time in the meditation where you're sort of sitting down, wherever it is, and you can't get comfortable. Say, great, I'm not going to be comfortable. I'm going to be content with not being comfortable. Let go. When you're content with not being comfortable, then the discomfort disappears. You find out it's not the body causing the problem, it's the mind looking for something to distract itself. So often that happens. When I was asked yesterday about these thoughts coming in the mind, sort of, you know, they come by themselves. No, you bring them in. You're, because of discontent, You say, come on thought, come on fantasy, sometimes come on sound. You actually listen for sounds. Or you look around and see, you know, who's doing what in this meditation room. You know, justify fault with somebody. This is, you know, it's just discontent, that's all. Making restlessness. So all of these little things which cause restlessness, know them, create contentment, saying this is good enough, I'm content here. Build up contentment. This which you are seeing right now is good enough. Be content with it. Allow it to be. Move into the centre of things. And if you move into the centre of things, you find it is good enough. So often in the meditation you start, if your mind's all over the place, it's tired, it's not got much happiness there, whatever, just be content with that. So isn't it wonderful just to be like this? And then you find all the happiness and energy come by itself. Restlessness is overcome through contentment. Content with the food. Content with your place of sleeping. Content with your body. Content with the state of your meditation. Content with your mind. Content with your stage on the path of liberation. If you can be like that, then enlightenment comes to you. Jhanas come to you. Rather than you going seeking for things. And the last of the hindrances is called doubt. When it calls doubt, Buddha actually meant it as somebody being lost in the desert with no guidance, with no landmarks, with no map. Basically, that's my job to overcome doubt for you, to give you, make it very clear exactly what you're supposed to be doing, what the signposts are, where you are, what you're supposed to do next. That's how you overcome doubt. So it's like having all the instructions really, really clear. And also remembering them. There's two parts of mindfulness. One is being alert, and the other one is remembering the instructions. It's a waste of time being alert if you don't remember which way you're supposed to be going. It's like a person driving a car. They're watching all the roads, but they don't know which way to go. They're lost. So remember the instructions as well as being alert. So, you remember what those hindrances are? You remember how to overcome them. So what's the first hindrance? Are you alert? Or were you alert? Do you remember the instructions? What's the first hindrance? Desire. And how do you overcome it? Ah, come on. Happiness. There you go. If you have happiness, you don't desire anything else. Second hindrance. And how do you overcome that? Loving kindness, remember that. Third hindrance. Stop and torpor. And how do you overcome that?
Enjoy it.
Yeah, that's good. No, okay. The fourth hindrance. And how do you overcome that? And the last hindrance, how do you overcome that? By paying attention when I'm speaking. Not falling asleep. Now, usually with those hindrances, whenever there's an obstacle in meditation, it has to be one of those hindrances or a group of them. And if it's a group of them, there'll be one which is a major hindrance. One which actually stands out. And this is why if you ever come across any problems in meditation, don't just be stupid and keep on banging your head against the same part of the brick wall again and again and again and again. Getting frustrated, getting nowhere, wasting your time. If there's a blockage in the meditation, it's not happening, then stop. And ask yourself, those five hindrances, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, which one is it? What's actually stopping me from going deeper into peace, into clarity, into freedom? Identify it. Once you've identified it, remember the antidote and apply that antidote. For example, if there's desire, you're thinking about the food, you're thinking about going home, you're thinking about watching the TV, missing your favourite movie or whatever it is, then it's happiness. You put some more happiness into the moment. Now if it's ill will, you're feeling grouchy and negative and grumpy and nothing is right, I can't do anything. Ajahn Brahm is so stupid, tells always the same jokes every time, just shared Buddhist parable. If there's negativity there, put in loving kindness. Spend a few minutes just doing loving kindness meditation. Or doing loving kindness on the breath or whatever else. And if it's sloth and torpor, then go back to your room and take a rest. If it's restlessness and worry, contentment. Develop contentment, a bit of gratitude for the moment. And if it's doubt, then go outside, in that box is a piece of paper, and write your question on the box. So know exactly what it is, and then apply the antidote, and then you find it works. Last thing about the obstacles of meditation, sometimes it is some obstacle which comes up again and again and again and again. It's your big obstacle which you can't overcome, or you don't seem to be able to overcome. It stops you all the time. And if that happens, please remember, you know, what you've heard before called the simile of the snake. The simile of the snake is my simile, it's not in the sutras, because it came from the early life as a monk in Northeast Thailand, when it was a very poor monastery in Ajahn. It wasn't famous at that time, not very famous. And so sometimes we didn't have any batteries for our flashlights. We had flashlights, but no batteries. I remember going to Ajahn Chah's hut once and saying, can I have some batteries, please? Because, you know, I haven't got any batteries, and there's snakes, and there's these biting ants, and scorpions, and centipedes around. And he said, with compassion, I'm sorry, we haven't got any batteries. And so, you know, for quite a few weeks, you had to walk, after the evening meetings, walk back to your hut in the darkness, using starlight, or moonlight if you were lucky, knowing there were snakes and all these other creepy crawlies around the forest who regarded you as their dinner, who had legitimate rights to bite you because they were there first. And of course it was dangerous. And so every evening when I walked back in the starlight, whenever there was like a dark shape across the path, you'd either jump over it or you'd take another path, because that could be a snake. And because I was really alert, as you would be walking through a jungle full of snakes without a flashlight, because we're really alert, never once did I get bitten. Now that was called a similar snake. You apply that to your meditation, whichever hindrance is your big hindrance, call that the snake. That's there in the path of meditation in front of you. It's lurking somewhere in the underbrush, ready to strike you. If you know it's out there, and if you are alert, mindful to its danger, then you'll see it before you step on it, before it can bite you, before it can get hold of you. This is how we deal with the big hindrances of our meditation. At the beginning of our meditation, we say, restlessness is my big hindrance. Restlessness, remember mind, be on the lookout for restlessness. Remember, this is the antidote to it, contentment. When you teach yourself that, you program yourself in that way, it means you're on the lookout for the big hindrance. So you go doing your meditation, present moment awareness, silence, or breath, or whatever. And what happens then is you're taught, you've instructed mindfulness. This main instruction, be careful of that hindrance, that snake of restlessness. And then you're walking along the path of meditation, metaphorically speaking. And then you start to see restlessness come. And because you programmed yourself, because you're alert to its danger, you've told yourself, be on the lookout. You notice it quickly. And mindfulness remembers the instructions what to do. It's a snake, jump over it. If it's a big snake, don't even try to jump over it, go the other way. You take evasive action. That's actually how you overcome those hindrances in meditation. So, whichever hindrance it is, if it's a hindrance which keeps coming up again and again and again, use a simile of the snake. Beginning of the meditation, tell yourself, I've got to be careful of this one. Really look out for it. And then you'll be able to see it before it catches you. And you will take evasive action. And that's how we overcome the hindrances to meditation. Meditation is a smooth, easy path. It's because of defilements, hindrances, bad attitudes, conditioning. That's why meditation doesn't work. So you can do it, just find out what's stopping you. these hindrances. Find out what they are. What pushes you out rather than allows you to come in. And if you can find that and overcome it, your meditation will become far more efficient, waste less time, become more happy, more peaceful, and have a lovely time in this meditation. So those are the hindrances, the obstacles to meditation. Are there any questions on that? Yes?
I think that if it's not happening, you're living the meditation, when you go out and open your eyes, and then you feel like so happy the more I wanted to get out of the body and wanted to want to be free and so you just like I'm not sure what to like just stop or
just don't do anything. If you want things to be free, remember that freedom comes from contentment. It doesn't matter what happens, where you are, whether you're in a prison or in a monastery, if you're content to be there, that's called freedom. If you try and sort of say, I'm not happy, I want the mind to go out there, the mind goes out there, I'm not happy being out there, I want it to be back in my body, that's not freedom anymore. That's more control, that's being in prison again. Let go. We'll see what happens. Yeah?
Could you just explain the qualitative difference between the end of the first one, which is sensory desire, I guess it's the habits, being happy, and the fourth one, which is restlessness, which is the end of that being content?
Well, they're both really the same, because sensory desire is a type of restlessness. When you're restless, what do you go and do? You just go to the fridge, go to the TV, go out looking for happiness. So it's a type of sensory desire. So contentment, happiness. Sometimes it may not be so specific as to want things. Sometimes you don't know what you want, but you still want something. That's called the restlessness. So contentment is actually coming much closer to the heart of restlessness, which is the lack of stillness, fault finding again. The sensory desire is a more coarser form, but it's still very important to actually understand that that's, the antidote is happiness. Contentment can be very, very still and not have much oomph to it, but happiness has the power to overcome the very strong forces of desire. Because people can be very content. This is one of the problems in meditation. They can be sitting there again in a very content stage, very peaceful. There's not no power. They've got no happiness there. They're still, but they're not joyful. That's not good enough actually to overcome sensory desire.
So what's the trick to moving from contentment into joy? Increase the power.
Increase the power, put more and more energy into mindfulness. So basically just the mind is just huge amounts of power, whatever it looks like, it's got so much happiness. This is that old thing which hopefully you'll experience, I think you should all experience sometime in this retreat. Have a really nice meditation, you go outside and those plants, those flowers look so beautiful. More beautiful than you've ever seen before. The same bushes, the same grass, the same ferns outside. But there come a time you go outside and look at them, wow, they are so beautiful. That green is just so lovely. What's going on there? The caretakers haven't been polishing the flowers. It's just that the mind has become bright and it sees more deeply into things. And it sees more beauty. It actually sees with happiness. This is what actually happens. More and more you get happier and happier and happier because the mind gets brighter and brighter and brighter. You see deeper and deeper and deeper. So that's just what happens. And that's where the real happiness which overcomes sensory desire comes from. That's how monks overcome sensory desire. The happiness born of huge, powerful mindfulness. Okay, so that's enough for now. If you have any more questions, please put them on the piece of the paper because now we've got interrogation. Oh, sorry, I mean interview time. Oops. I said it on purpose. So the first person...